Family, that's a great example of worshiping our God through the events of life. This is life. This is part of life. And just as when we look at the book of Ruth, we see God working in what's often called the dark providence, dark times in people's life, let's never forget that his invisible hand is on every single moment in our lives. It's on every single moment in your life, every single moment in our lives, every single moment in Naomi, Boaz, and Ruth's life. And as we look at this story of Ruth, it begins at a time when there's no king in Israel. Yet, interestingly, the book ends with a lineage of a king named David. And he's called the king after God's own heart. He's called the greatest king of Israel. But then we're left to wonder as we look backwards, whatever happened to that king? Was David truly the greatest king? Was he the ultimate king? Was he the final king? And we have to answer no. We're still waiting for something or someone else. And if you look at these 85 verses, because the book of Ruth is so short, it's only 85 verses, but 55 of them are conversations. 55 of these verses are people talking about what God is doing in their life, about how God is working in their life. This is the kind of story that if you had a Proverbs 31 type woman and she was sitting around with younger women, she would sit down and call the younger women around them and say, "Let me tell you about this woman named Ruth. Let me tell you what a true Proverbs 31 woman looks like." Or if she was talking to young single women, she would say, "Come here. Let me tell you what true godliness looks like in your singleness. And let me show you what true godliness looks like in potential husbands by looking at this man, Boaz." And if you were a godly man, this is the type of story that you would tell as you gathered the young men around you, maybe over a campfire. And they're all listening to you and the flames are bursting into the shadows on your face and your mouth illuminates as your lips start to curl on the end as you lean forward and say, "Men, listen to what happens next." This is a story. And God gives it to us in story form. This is a story that starts in Bethlehem, and then it goes to Moab, then it comes back to Bethlehem, then it goes to Israel, then it comes back to Bethlehem, then it goes to the fields, then it comes back to Bethlehem, then it goes to the threshing room floor, and it's right back to Bethlehem. And you're left to ask, what is so special about Bethlehem? You're left to ask, can anything good really ever come out of Bethlehem? Can anything good indeed come out of Bethlehem is the question you should be asking yourself. And you're starting to make connections in your mind already just thinking about this story. This is a story that's just filled with irony after irony after irony. Do you know what Bethlehem means? It means the house of bread. Yet do you realize Bethlehem is in the midst of a famine? There is no bread in the house of bread. That's an irony. And so God's people, this small family, they leave the house of bread because there's no bread in the house of bread. And they go to a land called Moab, which is a land of fertility. They worshiped a false god of fertility. They're known for their fertility. And yet the family moves there and all the men die and all the women become barren. And all that happens in the land of fertility. That's irony. So there's no bread in the house of bread. There's no fertility in the land of fertility. And you have this woman named Naomi, which means sweet. After 10 years of dark providence, after 10 years of pain, after 10 years of grief, she wants to change her name to Mara, which means bitterness. So sweet wants to turn into bitterness. That's irony. And then you have this woman named Ruth. She's a Moabite woman. She's from a group of people who came into existence because of an ancestral relationship. She's from a group of people that leads God's people into sin, yet this Moabite woman is the one God uses to lead his people back into faithfulness to himself. That's irony. This story is filled with one irony after another. This is a culture that is dominated by men, yet who are the main characters in the story? Women. That's more irony. So what we have to ask ourselves is, how should we read this story? How do you read the book of Ruth? How do you read the book of Ruth in such a way where you're going to grow in your affections towards your Savior, Jesus Christ? And one way we can read the book of Ruth is by understanding this is a true story. These are true people. These are real events. This is God working in the difficulties of life. And you're able to see that God works in every single circumstance, not just the big events, but God's working in even the small events, the most mundane events. And you can look to Ruth, you can look to Naomi, you can look to Boaz, and you can look to them as examples in your life. You can look to them and you can emulate them in your life. But don't do that exclusively. And what I mean by that is, we don't want to see the Bible as simply moral teachings. We don't want to treat the Bible, these historical narratives in the Bible, and treat them like Aesop's fables. We don't want to look at them and say, what's the moral teaching here? We do want to be courageous like Esther. We do want to be faithful like Abraham. We don't want to give in and conform to the world like Solomon. We do want to show love, to show faithfulness like Ruth. But we don't want to treat the Bible like it's just a series of moral lessons. We don't want to treat the Bible like it's just the human characters are the main point, because behind every story, there's a main character, and the main character is our Savior. The main character is our God. So we want to get behind the human characters in every story. Yes, look to the human examples. Yes, use them to emulate, to follow. But never miss the point. The ultimate story is about Jesus Christ. So let's remember, the entire Bible is one story. It's not a bunch of separate stories that are just kind of compiled together. It's one book, it's one story, and the one story is the plan of redemption. And when we enter this book of Ruth, we enter into this one story. We're in a time when there's no king, when God's people don't know which direction to go, when God's people don't know whom to follow, when God's people don't know how they should live their life. And by the time we get to the end of the story, we have a lineage of a king that leads us to a final king, that leads us to a king who is going to right the wrong from Genesis 3:15. He's going to be the one that was promised, the one who's going to crush the head of the serpent. We're introduced to a king, and it's the very king that the tabernacle pictured. You see, the tabernacle is a temporary structure where God's people could be in the presence of God, where they could dwell with their God, but the tabernacle was temporary. The temple was temporary. We're introduced through this story to a man who is going to tabernacle with his people and fulfill what the temple and the tabernacle pointed to. We're introduced to a man that Isaiah called Emmanuel, which means what? God with us, because in the garden it was us with God. After the fall, it was us without God. And then through the tabernacle and temple, it was us with God, but in a very temporary sense, in a very limited sense. But in this one that this story introduces to us, it's God with us, not simply us with God. We're introduced to the one that Psalm 2 says is the final king, the one that Psalm 2 says is the king that is going to reign and rule for eternity. And perfectly. We're introduced to the one that John 1:1 says, in the beginning he was with God, in the beginning he was God. We're introduced to the one that in John 1:14 we're told he's going to go to a place, which is the cross, to prepare a place for us. We're introduced to the one that John 14:6 says, he is the way, he is the truth, he is the life, and he's the only way we can be right with the Father. He's the only way we can come to the Father. You see, this story is part of that one story. We're being introduced to a king that in John 14:3 says you have to know him, meaning love him, to have eternal life. We're introduced to the one that Revelation 23 says he is the way we will eternally dwell in tabernacle and see our God face to face. It's the one 1 Peter calls the person who's going to bring us to God himself. You see, the book of Ruth is not a separate story. It's part of that one story, that grand story of redemption. So when we open the book of Ruth, we have to read the book of Ruth and see, how does this continue the story of redemption? How does it point to my Savior? How does it point to my King? How does it point to the one who took on human flesh so that we could dwell eternally with him? How does the conflict and the resolution that is resolved in this story point to a greater resolution in the person and work of Jesus Christ? You see, this story is a gospel story. This story is about the good news of who Jesus Christ is and what Jesus Christ will accomplish and has accomplished. So once again, it's not about us, is it? It's all about him. So As we read this book of Ruth, there's a theological concept that's kind of difficult to wrap our minds around, but I want you to kind of think about it. I want you to start to whet your appetite towards it. And it's a theological term called providence. So we have to understand, what is the providence of God? And if you just glance at the text, look at Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. I want to introduce you to the providence of God. In chapter 1, verse 1, the author says, in the days when the judges ruled, or I love how the NASB, the New American Standard, captures that. It says, now it came about in the days that the judges ruled. So it's kind of like this. It just so happened that this story takes place in the days that the judges ruled. And that's a term that's going to be used throughout this book. It just so happened that Ruth showed up in the field of Boaz. It just so happened that on the day she showed up in the field of Boaz, Boaz just happened to show up on that day too. And the author keeps doing this. The author keeps saying, it just so happened. So you start to think, well, is this by chance? Is this by happenstance? Is this by circumstance? And you're left with, no, this is God's providence. This is God interacting with his people. This is God working in the ordinary events in our lives. Not just the big events, the ordinary events in our lives. So we need to define providence so when we read this story of Ruth, and so when we work verse by verse through this story of Ruth, we understand that it's God who is working in this story, and so we understand how he works. So you ready for me to define providence? I can't just do it yet. I have to first define sovereignty to you. You hear that term a lot. God is sovereign. We know what that means on the big scale. God is in control. Let me give you a poetic way of saying God is sovereign, because if I can show you that God is sovereign, then I can show you what it means that God rules through providence. And he rules in our lives through providence. So Psalm 135 tells us what it means for God to be sovereign. In Psalm 135, verse 6, we hear this, whatever the Lord pleases, and that's Yahweh, whatever the Lord pleases, he does in heaven and on earth, in the seas and in all the deeps. So that means whatever God pleases, whatever God desires is what God does. And where does he do it? Well, in heaven, on earth, in the seas, in the deepest part of the seas, that which is humanly uncontrollable, which means God controls every single area of his created order, which means there is not one single rogue molecule, not one single rogue atom that exists in all of God's created order. God is above and beyond and has his hand over every single thing, and nothing happens outside of his decree. There's not a thing that takes God by surprise. There's not a thing that God said, wow, I didn't see that coming. He allows everything that takes place to take place. And that means everything. The number of hairs on your head. The orbit of our planets, how much rain is falling outside. It means the appointment of our political leaders, whether we get political leaders we want or political leaders that we deserve. It means your IQ. It means a wayward child. It means an unloving parent. It means a difficult marriage. It means a stressful job. It means even an abusive parent. It means even a malignant tumor. When I say that God is sovereign, it means God controls everything. And that's where the pushback comes in, right? How many of you are squirming in your seats right now? I'm squirming up here, so you're not the only one. Because we have to say, well, wait, what about human choice? What about human decisions? What about human will? What about the fallen nature? What about the sin of others? That God's over that too. But the fact that God is sovereign and that God controls everything does not in any way, any shape, or any form discount human choice. It does not discount human decisions. It does not discount human wickedness. It doesn't discount that at all. We're still morally responsible for every act that we do. And we will stand, and every human being will have to give an account to their God. And you're going to stand before your judge. And unless you're clothed in the righteousness of Jesus Christ, you won't be able to stand for very long. There's no defense. So the fact that I say God is sovereign, he controls everything, does not mean that we're discounting your choices or human free will. But what it does mean is what God decrees in eternity, man demands and accomplishes in time. Does that make sense? What God decrees in eternity past, before he created the heavens and the earth, what he decreed to take place is exactly what each and every one of us demand and accomplish. Let me give you an example. I want everybody to imagine, this is going to be hard to do, but imagine a corrupt political leader, right? You can't do it? Okay. Let me give you a corrupt political leader to think about. Pontius Pilate. Okay. Because nobody else could think of a different corrupt political leader. I know that. Sorry about that. I had you thinking about something that's, you know, just not very common nowadays. But imagine Pontius Pilate. He's standing before the crowd. He's standing before a mob of people who are frothing at the mouth. Their hatred is boiling inside and it's starting to spew over. And he stands before them and he does what he often does. He says, I have two men here. I'm going to release one of them to you. Should I release this murderer? This man named Barabbas? This man who has a death sentence over his head because he committed an act that he deserves to die for? Or should I release Jesus to you? A man who I can find no sin in. A man who I can find who did nothing wrong. Do you remember what the crowd said? We want Barabbas. Release Barabbas. Give us Barabbas. So he gets in front of the crowd, this corrupt political leader, and he takes his hand and he dips it in this bowl of water and he symbolically washes his hands of the blood of Christ. And he says, this blood is not on me. It's on you. Do you remember what the crowd shouted? Let it be on us. And they didn't just say, let it be on us. They said, let it be on us and our children. Crucify him. So, let me ask you a question. What did God decree before the foundations of the heavens and the earth to happen to his son? To be crucified. What did that mob demand and accomplish at that moment in history? For Jesus to be crucified. Let's take it a step further. Do you think that they knew that they were fulfilling God's eternal decree, something the sovereign God said will happen and will take place at this moment by these people at this time? Do you think they knew that they were part of this? Do you think they knew they were playing the part they were supposed to play? No. Let's go a little bit further. Do you think that in any way, shape, or form, God came in and altered their will, altered their desires, made them do something that they didn't want to do or think something that they didn't want to think? No. That was their own actions. That was their own desire. That was their own will. That was their own choice. Nonetheless, God ordained this to take place at this moment by these people before the foundations of the heavens and the earth. And it wasn't God simply looking into the future, seeing what's going to happen, because then he wouldn't be sovereign. The people would be. God ordained it. They're morally accountable for it. There is not one rogue atom in this universe. There's not one rogue molecule in this universe. There's not one rogue cell in your body. God's in control of everything. That's what sovereignty means. So if sovereignty, the fact that God is sovereign, speaks about how God foreordains everything, then the providence of God means this is how God works out everything that he ordained in eternity's past. Is it starting to become clear what it means that God is or leads and rules through his providence? He decrees because he's sovereign, and then he carries everything out by his invisible hand, and that's called providence, where he works out his predetermined plan and his predetermined purposes in time, in history, in this very moment. Nothing happened in this worship service that took God by surprise. So the providence of God is God steering every single detail of your life, every single detail of your life to its predetermined end. So it's God not only steering every detail in your life, but he's steering every single aspect of the created order. You see how providence and sovereignty of God are so intertwined together? To understand one is to understand the other. So this is why it's so important when we get to the book of Ruth and it says it just came about, it just happened to be in the days of the judges, that we understand it wasn't by accident, it wasn't by happenstance, it wasn't by circumstance. This is by God's providence. He is working in these ordinary events. He is working in the lives of his people. And it takes place in a very dark period of history. The period of the judges. Right? Look back at verse 1, in the days when the judges ruled. Now, to a Hebrew mind, the original audience reading this book, they would think this is a time of moral degeneracy. This is a time of religious apostasy. This is a time when there's no king. This is a time when we had severe economic catastrophe. This is a time of great sin and heartache. But to us, it's just words on a page. It's hard for us to read this line. This happened in the period of Judges and think, well, God's working in the darkest period and he's working in my life and he's working through this because we're so disconnected from 11th century, 12th century BC. Because it's so different from our lives. So let's just see, is it really that different from our culture? Let's just see, is it really that different from our lives? So if we want to see what the period of Judges is like, what book do you think we should go to? Joshua, you're exactly right. So turn to the book of Joshua, because every one of you were right, and go to chapter 24, because when you get to Joshua chapter 24, he had just spent the previous chapter giving these final farewell addresses, and he's telling people about God's faithfulness, and he's telling them that there's blessing if they act one way, and there's warning, there's curses if they act a different way. And he makes sure that the people know by the time we get to Joshua 24 that God is faithful to his promises, but he's also faithful to his warnings. And the people need to hear that. So you get to chapter 24 of the book of Joshua. He gives one final presentation as God, as king. That's what he's doing in chapter 24. He's presenting God with the language that people would talk about their kings. And he talks about the relationship God has had with his people. Then he talks about the requirements one last time, how they're supposed to live, how they're supposed to behave. And he goes over the blessing and the curses one more time. Now look at Joshua 24. Look at verse 15. This is going to set us up for what it means to be in the period of the judges. Joshua 24, verse 15. He says, If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord. Did you hear that? If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord. Now, why would he word it like that? Of course it's not disagreeable in our sight to serve the Lord. Or is it? You see, he'd been teaching the people, to speak anachronistically, he'd been teaching the people what it means to pick up your cross and die to yourself. He'd been teaching the people that this is how you're supposed to live in God's kingdom. This is how you're supposed to live if you're in relationship with God. And if you live this way, there'll be blessing. And if you don't live this way, there's going to be discipline, severe discipline. So choose for yourself. Do you want to follow God? Or does this look too difficult? Do you want to follow God, or does it look like it's not worth it? Do you want to follow God, or are you worried about what you have to give up? Do you want to follow God, or would you rather be successful? Do you want to follow God, or would you rather have a bigger home and more vehicles, I guess more camels? Yeah. Choose for yourself today. See, we have to make that choice today. Do we want to pick up our cross and die to ourselves? Do we want to count the cost of discipleship? Jesus wants to make sure his people count the cost of discipleship. He talked about a man who built a tower and didn't have enough money to finish it. Everybody mocked and ridiculed that man. See, we need to count the cost. We don't want to say, I'm following Jesus, and then walk away and have people look at it and say, well, I thought this person was a Christian. I guess it's too costly to follow Christ after all. See, we need to do the same thing that Joshua is warning the Israelites to do. Have we counted the cost? Is it agreeable to us? Really, is it really agreeable to follow God or not? We need to choose. We don't want to play games. We don't want to just give lip service. That does absolutely nothing. So let's read Joshua 24:15 again. See if it starts to connect with us. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the God which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are now living. Right? So who are you going to serve? You're going to serve your God, or are you going to serve your country? Are you going to serve your God, or are you going to serve the American dream? Are you going to serve your God, or are you going to serve your kingdom of comfort? Are you going to serve your God, or are you going to conserve, or are you going to serve your own kingdom? You're going to serve yourself? You're going to serve others? Who? And watch what he says. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. You have a choice. And your choice impacts those around you. It impacts your family. It impacts those who are dear to you. If you choose to follow Jesus Christ, there will be an impact. It'll ripple out into other people's lives around you. So you're not making an isolated choice. So choose today whom you will serve. Joshua says that. And then shortly after he dies, and his people are in the land, they're in the land God promised, and they're resting. They're secure. They're safe. This is where the book of Judges picks up. You can just turn to the next page. You're in Judges. So how will the people behave? So the leaders which Joshua trained, well, they've died off now. And now the people are not as committed to God. They're looking around the culture around them. They see how the Canaanites were successful, and it looks appealing to them. And they start to drift. They start to drift from God. They start to think, well, you know, relationship with God's important, but you know, so is my job, so is my community, so are all these other things. And they start to get further and further from God, and they start to be more excited about the false gods of the people around them and the way the people in the world are living. And they start to look more and more like the world. Matter of fact, it gets very difficult to tell the difference between an Israelite and a Canaanite in this period of time. Their lives look exactly the same. Church, do we look different than the world around us, or does our life look exactly the same as those around us? Our lives should look as different, even though we do all the same stuff. We go to work, we kiss our spouse, we play with our kids, we serve in our communities, but why we do it, how we do it, and the way we do it all looks different. But see, in the Israelites' lives, their lives were not looking different. Instead of driving out the Canaanites, they decided, well, let's live off their labor. Let's just enslave them. And so they started becoming influenced by them. Then they started marrying their women, and their daughters would marry their men. And then their religions kind of started becoming syncretized. And, well, this is good. Let's take this from the Canaanites. Let's add this to our worship of God. And then it started this horrific fivefold pattern of sin. And we need to understand this because this is important. This is why the author of Ruth sets this period here. It sets this fivefold cycle of life that just keeps continuing. It starts with sin, number one. The people just start sinning. They start committing more and more idolatry. Their lives become indistinguishable from the non-believers around them. And what God does next is he gives them over to slavery. So he allows an oppressor to overtake them. And now they're being controlled by someone on the outside. They're being controlled by the very lives of the people that they thought were attractive, and now they're finding out it's not. This is slavery. So it starts with sin, then it goes to slavery. So then it moves to supplication. They start to cry out to God, and they say, God, forgive us for turning away from you. This is slavery. We thought this was freedom, but this is actually slavery. Please forgive us. Please rescue us. So it goes from sin to slavery to supplication as they're asking God to save them. So then God sends them a savior. They're called a judge. And this judge is a strong, charismatic leader. And they come in and they lead God's people. They lead them out of this slavery. And they drive out the enemy. And they're victorious. And then they have a period of security where that judge helps the people stay faithful to God. And if only it ended right there, Judges would be a great book. But it doesn't. As soon as they get comfortable, as soon as they taste security, the cycle starts over. And this time the sin is even more grotesque than it was in the last period. And then the slavery becomes worse. So they have supplication. They cry out in prayer. Then God sends them another savior. Then they have more security. And then the sin gets even worse. And that cycle just continues. And it continues until you get to Judges 21, verse 25, the very last verse in Judges. And scripture reads, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Does that sound like something we can't connect with? Or can we connect with 11th and 12th century BC? We live in a culture where everyone does what is right in their own eyes. We live in a culture where you're no longer a good person. You're no longer a moral person if you do what's best for your family and you do what's best for your community and then you do what's best for your nation. Now, in our culture, you are an authentic person. You are a good moral person when you do what's right in your own eyes. That's the only way to be authentic in today's culture, right? You just got to do what's right in your own eyes, even if it damages your family, even if it damages your community, even if it damages your society, even if it damages your nation, right? Everything is up to you. Even your gender is up to you. Your sexuality is up to you. Right and wrong is up to you. Everyone does what's right in their own eyes. So are you starting to see the similarities between the period of the judges and 21st century America? We're very much alike. You see, the Israelites, they saw this community, and they were trying to figure out, how do we become a nation? And they looked at the Canaanites, who were an agricultural society, and that's what Israel has to become now. They have to become an agricultural society. They'd never done this before. And they looked at the Canaanites, and the Canaanites were doing it well. The Canaanites cared about the same stuff we care about today. The Canaanites cared about, how do I make a living for my family? How do I have full employment for the people I care about and for my community and for my nation? And how do I have security? How do we thrive as a people? Aren't those the exact same things we're caring about? Isn't that what dominates much of our conversation with politics, or at least what should dominate much of our conversation with politics? The Canaanites care about the same thing. And see, the Canaanites used religion as a way to accomplish everything they wanted. So they created these false gods. They said, well, there's a false god named Baal who handles all the cycles of life. We're an agricultural society, therefore we need water, so we need the gods to remember to bring the rain at the right time so that we can water our livestock, so we can water our crops, so we can feed our family, so we can make a living. But that wasn't enough. They needed large families so that they could take care of their farms and they could take care of the work that they're doing, so they could have workers. So they started worshiping a god of fertility. So they had Baal and they had Asherah, these two false gods. And then they would commit these acts of great, intense sexual immorality to get the god's attention so that they would provide children and so that they would provide rain. They used their religion to get exactly what they wanted from their gods. And Israel looked at that and said, that is pleasing to me. That is beautiful to me. I want to control my environment. I want to have rain when I want to have rain. I want to have fertility when I want to have fertility. I want a large family. I want these things. So Israel started following the pattern of the world around them, using their religion as if God was created to serve them rather than being created to serve God. If that isn't evangelical Christianity in America today, I don't know what is. And I say evangelical Christianity much the same way Christ talked about Phariseeism. You see, being a Pharisee was a good thing. They were the holy people. They were the people that cared. They looked at the world, and the world was corrupt. They looked at Israel. Israel's religion was corrupt. So they went back to the Bible. If you were a Pharisee and you were part of the Pharisees, you were part of the right group of people. But what happened is anytime something becomes mainstream, which Phariseeism did, then it becomes commercial, and then it becomes corrupt. So Christ comes in, and even though there were still good Pharisees, even there were still good Pharisees who were operating, there were still good Pharisees who defended Christ with some doctrine, there were still good Pharisees like Nicodemus who came, teacher, you are a good teacher, teach me. And even though there are Pharisees who put their faith and trust in Jesus after the resurrection, Jesus speaks about Pharisaism with a blanket statement, because it has become corrupt. And we have to be able to speak that way about evangelicalism. See, if you were a good Pharisee and you heard Jesus condemn Phariseeism, you would say, oh yeah, he's right. That stuff is wrong. So how do we know if we're good evangelicals when we hear criticism against evangelical Christianity that is unbiblical, and the criticism's true because what the church is doing is unbiblical? We go, they're right. The church does look like the world now. The church does have the priorities of the world. The church kind of looks like the marketplace when Jesus came in and cleansed it. So loud, I can't even think of why I'm there. I need earplugs. Things are being sold left and right. There's jumpy houses. It's a game. No one's taking their sin seriously. No one's taking God seriously. Holiness isn't serious in our lives anymore. You see, our lives are exactly like the lives of the Israelites. And this book takes place in the dark providence, and our lives look just like it. Now, I spent this time this morning trying to introduce us to this period of the Judges so we could make some connection. Because what we're going to see that in this dark time, there are still faithful people. There are still people who love God. There are still true believers. There are still people who are living lives of faith and lives of joy, and they're abundant lives. See, we can do the exact same thing. God's church cannot be defeated. Even though it might look dark right now, even though we might be under the hand of the dark providence here in our nation, God is still faithful. God is still in control. And God is still working in your lives individually and corporately as a family. Our God is sovereign. Our God is in control. He wants us to know there's another side. Even though there's apostasy, violence, immorality, strife, there is faith. There is true faith. There is active faith. There is living faith. Because we serve a living God who is a faithful God who loves you. So family, I want us to seek as we work through this book over the next 7 weeks. I want us to seek to have the type of confidence that the author of Ruth has in the providence of God. That God is in this, God is on this, God is working through this. I want you to have that confidence. I want you to have that faith. I want you to have that trust as we discover the deeper hero of the story. As we discover that there is a king behind everything. Even though we're in a period where there is no king in our nation, just like there is no king in the land of Israel during this period, even though we're living on this side of the cross, we can still look back and we can see what Naomi, what Ruth, what Boaz learned about a redeemer. And we can say, I get it. I see it more clearly than they do. We can also learn what it meant for Naomi and for Ruth to be under the wing of their Redeemer. And I want you to understand what it means for you to be under the wing of your Redeemer, to be under the wing of your King, to be under the wing and protection and take refuge in your Jesus, in your Christ. That's what we're going to learn as we look into this book. God has seen you in your despair, just like he has seen Naomi in hers, Ruth in hers, and he has brought them through it, and God will bring you through your despair. Your God is faithful. He has given you a redeemer. He has given you a king. He has given you a savior. He has given you Emmanuel, God with us, Jesus Christ, the King. Family, I want you to understand that if you grant me to come back next week, we will walk through this book together, and you will learn and you will see that this is a book about you and this is a book for you. Are you ready for the book? All right, let's open up to Ruth chapter 1. And we're not going to close with our normal songs today because we had a slight delay in God's providence. So we're going to end with the reading. And then after I'm finished with the reading, we'll partake in communion together. But open up to Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. I want to introduce you to this poem of Ruth. Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab, and they remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These two took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah. The name of the other was Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. And both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the women were left without two sons and her husband. And then she arose with her daughter-in-laws and returned to the country of Moab, for she had heard the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and had given them food. So she set out from this place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return, each of you, to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices, and they wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I sons in my womb that you may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go away, for I am too old to have a husband. I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons. Would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. But Ruth clung to her, and she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the woman said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now, Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man, a man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him, in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." And then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers said, "She's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came and has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." And then Boaz said to her, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." And then she fell on her face, bowing on the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and your mother and your native land to come to the people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." And she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me, and you have spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here, eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers and passed to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. And when she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even from the sheaves, and do not reproach her." and also pull out some of the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her. So she gleaned in the field until evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she also brought out and gave her food that she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "This man with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness who has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours. He is one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go with these young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and the wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. And then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may go well with you? Is not Boaz a relative with whom the young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. And when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say, I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went down into the end of the heap of the grain. And she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled, and he turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your garment, spread your wings over your servant, for you are my redeemer." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than your first kindness, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now, it is true that I am a redeemer. Yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if not, if he's not willing to redeem you, then, as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until morning." So she lay at his feet until morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, "Let it not be known that a woman came to the threshing floor." And he said, "Bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. And then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did you fare, my daughter?" And then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" And she replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how matters turn out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." Now Boaz had gone up to the gate, and he sat down. And behold, the redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside, and he sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. And then he said to the redeemer, "Naomi has come back from the country of Moab and is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you and say to you, but buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." And then Boaz said, "Well, the day you buy the field, the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate her name and the name of the dead of his inheritance." And the redeemer said, "Well, I can't redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now, this was the custom for times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm a transaction. The one drew off his sandal and he gave it to the other. And this was the manner of a testing in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. And then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are my witnesses this day that I have bought the hand of Naomi, all that belonged to Elimelech, and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon, also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon. I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. The name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. And then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah because of the offspring the Lord will give you by this young woman. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap, and became his nurse. And the woman of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nashon. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. Family, so reads the words of the living God. May he richly bless the reading of his word.